This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 95-year-old Pearl Harbor survivor Stu Headley of Claremont, California. On December 7th, 1941, he was aboard the battleship USS West Virginia. And when we left off, he and a fellow sailor were trying to figure out how to escape their burning ship and get to the USS Tennessee nearby. They had just watched five of their friends try to cross on a line between the two ships, only to see them mowed down by machine gun fire from an enemy plane. Stu was determined to find another way across.
As I was watching the Oklahoma capsize, we had 5-inch 38 anti-aircraft guns that stuck out over the side of the ship. Mm-hmm. So I said, "Crossin, did you ever run down a railroad track?" He said, "What are you talking about?" I says, "Did you ever walk on a well, when I was a kid, as you're going to do it today." "What do you mean?" I said, "You see that gun barrel? We're going to go over in the Marine casemate starboard side, climb up on that gun barrel, run across it, and jump down in the Tennessee. The gun barrel is about that big around."
Yeah, a couple feet wide.
Five inch. And so he says, "You go first." I says, "Okay." So I usually ask the kids, "Where do you think I was going when I hit the deck of the Tennessee?" They don't have. I says, "I was going right back up into turret 3. That's my battle station." You talk about Pavlov's law. And I was on the third rung when a Marine lifted me off with his foot. Crosin was still coming down the deck. And he said, "Haven't you had enough of those turrets? What do you want us to do? Get over on the beach." I says, "How? Swim, you idiot." And the fire, as you saw in that picture just a minute ago, this is the oil that's blazing on the water from the ships. Crosin and I went over on the starboard side of the Tennessee. Here's all these nice, neatly piled clothes and shiny shoes. So I said, "Crosin, we're going to strip down to our shorts, undershorts, and we're going to jump in. We're not going to dive." I says, "We don't want to hit our head on anything." And I said, "Go just as deep as you can and swim underwater." Well, I qualified as an ABC swimmer in boot camp, not an underwater swimmer. But I'll guarantee I swam underwater that morning or I wouldn't be here.
How far did you have to go?
I would say about twice the distance we are to that wall. Not too far, but with that burning oil, and like I say, I wasn't an underwater swimmer. I came up twice, and I thrashed like mad to get that oil and fire away. Hottest breath I ever breathed in my life. It's a wonder it didn't scorch my lungs. Twice we broke surface. The next time we were at the beach, and they took us right over to the dispensary and walked right across the deck, and it's a great big red cross. It's an open patio style with a deck all the way around with a railing. And we went up there. They examined us for any burns or any lacerations, any wounds of any kind. And they had tables and chairs and cots, a bed that they moved out, anything that they could put a body on. I was asked to speak out at UCSD. And this gal said, "Stuart, when you get to the point where you were at the dispensary, I want you to tell, you're going to be speaking to 85 doctors, surgeons, their admirals and generals, and I want you to tell them what your supplies were that morning." I says, "Kathy, you mean that?" I said, "They've got the finest of equipment and everything." "Yes." I said, "All right." So when I got to this point, they gave us a tube of unguentine ointment, put on the burns. They gave us a jar of sulfa drug. That's to pour into the wounds and lacerations. Then they gave us morphine, cans of morphine, to minister to those that were dying or in dire pain. With those three items, we saved lives. Well, we were taking care of these fellows, And it's now about 9:25, and the second wave is coming in. And while we were taking care of these fellows, I looked up and I saw two planes approaching Fort Island. And I yelled, "Duck!" And we went under the benches, the tables, whatever we could. And glass just shattered all over the place. And one of the planes, when it lifted up, dropped a bomb right in the center of that patio. Now, 59 years later, on a Tiger cruise, the year 2000, we went over to Hawaii. And I told the fellas, I want to go to that dispensary that I was in. So I walked right across the decking, walked up the stairs, and they're all dental offices across there now. I walked in, and these are corpsmen that are working with dentistry. And I said, 59 years ago, I was in this building. Those kids, what are you talking about? They didn't understand. They didn't know anything about the history of it. And I said, yes, 59 years ago, I was in this very building. Well, one of the dentists, who was a lieutenant commander, heard me. And he came over and he said, did I hear you right? You were in this building 59 years ago? That would have been December 7, 1941. I said, yes, sir. Come here, I'll show you something. I had walked right across that decking, and I took a picture. These are the three fellows that were with me. And we stopped the car, and we took photographs of the bullet holes down the landing field.
That are still there.
Yep.
Yep.
And this is a picture where I walked across the decking, but when he took me back down, I took a picture of what he showed me. That's where the bomb hit.
They have one tile in the floor there now that says, has a bomb, and it says December 7th, 1941.
Yep.
But on that date, I mean, this is a tile that's there now memorializing that.
Great big red cross was painted across that deck so that from the air, you would know that it was a dispensary or a hospital.
But that's exactly where they hit.
That's where they hit.
It was X marks the spot.
You better believe it.
What was the impact? What was the result of that bomb?
Well, dust flew all over everywhere. And I would say it was about 5 to 7, 8 minutes later that the dust cleared away. We looked over the banister. We didn't see a speck of red anywhere. Just literally tore that whole thing and turned it upside down.
The cross was gone.
Gone.
What about the patients that you guys had been treating?
They were still on the beds, but glass was all over them and everything. And there were about, I'd say pretty close to 50 to 100 fellows that were helping. They grabbed everybody they could, even those that were on Fort Island or those that came in off the ships.
Like you guys.
Yeah. And I'm going to put you to a test.
Uh-oh.
It's about 9:45. They told us you're needed back aboard ship to help fight fire. So they put us in a boat, took us back to our ship, and aboard the West Virginia, we had just gotten a new captain, Captain Benyon, and a new executive officer, Richard Hellencotter. And as soon as I got on the ship, the chief told me, Headley, you're going to handle the hose with the exec. He's going to handle the nozzle. You're going to hold the hose. When he cracked the hatch to the 3rd Division compartment, boom, boom, and I thought the Japanese are back, but it wasn't. The heat was so intense in the compartment that the moment he cracked that hatch and the air went in, it blew out our portholes. Took 45 minutes to cool that compartment down. When we got it cooled down, I said, Commander, could I check my locker? He says, where's your locker, son? I said, right there in the corner. Go right ahead. I opened up my locker. There's my blues, my dungarees, my whites, my underclothes, my socks, a pair of shoes, my pea coat, a sweater, my hats, all stowed away just as neat as anything. But the minute I touched them, they turned to powder from the heat. And it was amazing because I opened up the drawer and the stupidest thing, instead of sending my photographs home with the negatives, that locker drawer was just one mass of goo. Everything was gone. So then I opened the bottom drawer, and I had a pearl buckle in there because I was making square knot belts out of Belfast cord.
Uh-huh.
There was a half penny. Now, the story about the half penny goes back to October the 11th. The battleship Warspite, British battleship Warspite, came into port. They volunteered a group of us sailors to go over and mingle. And I was assigned to this British sailor. And he said, you know, he said, I don't have much that I could give you, but come on down to my locker and we'll see what I can find. So he took out this half penny and he said, I'll give you this. And he said, you know, you'll be in this war right alongside of us before long. I said, no. I said, we'll send you planes and tanks and ammunition. But and I thought to myself, what a prophecy when I saw that half penny. And I've still got that half penny. I drilled a hole through it and put a chain in it.
I'd love to see it. You know, you've described all this, and I know you've told your story hundreds of times, if not thousands of times. And I can't imagine how many lives have been impacted by your willingness to tell this story. But I'm struck by how much detail you remember. And the one thing I'm trying to figure out is how? How did you do all this? How did you manage to keep on going? And how terrified were you with this situation that nothing could have prepared you for?
Yes, there was a preparation. Because, see, we were out there a whole year before the attack. And we had battle drills. We had gun drills. We had man overboard drills. We had all kinds of drills that we were continuously practicing. So when the real thing happened, we're prepared. And we do just what we're trained to do.
But
and you
Stu,
don't stop. And
but, Stu, you saw bodies flying through the air. Then your body was blown back 8 feet. And you're holding your breath underwater because there's fire on the top. And you get to the beach. And when you get there, there's all these guys who are injured and maimed and dying. And you're treating them only to get bombed again where you're treating them. I mean, how can anything prepare you for that? And what
the
was
Lord.
It that, yeah, that was it.
The Lord prepared me for everything. He assured me, I will never leave you nor forsake you. I will be with you whatever you go through. That was where my faith was and my trust. That was all during the war. I went through 13 major engagements aboard the next ship, the San Francisco. The biggest battle we were in was Guadalcanal. Our ship was literally demolished. Eddie Huber and I were with damage control. We were electricians.
Mm-hmm.
We were assigned to go up and take over Gun 6. He was going to be the trainer. I was going to be the pointer. Gun 6 is the only gun that didn't get demolished. Gun 1, Gun 3, Gun 5, and 7 on the starboard side all took 14-inch shell hits. Gun 2, Gun 4, Gun 8 were wiped out. While we were on Gun 6, Gun 4 was destroyed. Joe Hubbard, who was our senior damage control officer, was walking on the deck behind us. When Gun 4 got hit, a piece of the shrapnel of the blast shield took his head right off his shoulders.
Oh.
He walked about 8 steps and then collapsed and died. We had 75% of our officers killed in 45 minutes aboard that ship. The admiral was killed. The captain was killed. The executive officer was killed. The gun boss was killed. Joe Hubbard, damage control officer, he was killed. We had 236 died that night. And the next morning, I was asked to help identify bodies. Well, we had a dog tag, two of them. On a chain around her neck. So I told Dr. Mamonas, I'll gladly do that for you. So I started with Gun 7, 5 bodies. I opened their mouth, put the dog tag between their teeth, clamped their jaws shut, put a red tag on them. I come up to Gun 5. This is the most horrible experience of my life. I told you about Johnny Anderson, who was in that boat when he saw the torpedo wake. And he was supposed to have been in turret 3 in the left gun,
right.
But he wasn't there. Well, he was a pointer on this 5-inch 25, and the shell came right through and tore him in half. His head and shoulders were underneath the vent. His lower torso and legs were dangling. I started laughing, and Dr. Monis doubled up his fist and hit me as solid as he could in the jaw. And he said, "Headley, you have every right to report me because an officer has no authority to strike an enlisted man. But if I hadn't have done it, you would have gone stark raving mad. Snap me out of it." I went ahead and continued identifying bodies up the starboard side and down the port. And shortly after, the fellow said, "Headley, how about taking the watch in Central Station? This is about 10:30 in the morning, and I've got the JA phones on, and all of a sudden I hear 3 torpedo wakes on our port bow." I went up 5 flights of ladders, 5 decks, hit topside. Don Jenkins, first-class electrician, said, "Stu, who's in Central Station?" I said, "No one." He went right down. Those 3 torpedoes passed between the Helena and the Frisco and hit the Juno. And in 9 seconds, clocked on our chronometer in the bridge, there was no ship afloat. Wiped right out. Turret 3, or turret 1, or turret 2, was spinning through the atmosphere. And Hoover, who was the senior officer on board the Helena, was not about to stop to pick up any survivors because the Frisco could make 8 knots. We were heavily damaged. So we proceeded right on to Espirito Santo's. When we got in there, Hoover got a reprimand from Halsey like nothing for not attempting to pick up some of the men. But he told him, he said, "I knew there was a submarine in the area." And he said, "If I had dallied trying to get them, they could have picked us up."
Which would happen a little bit later on. That ship was sunk as well.
Yep. Well, we had 5 Medal of Honors awarded in one night aboard our ship. Admiral Callahan, Captain Casson Young, Commander Shondlin, Commander McCandless, and Robert Kepler, first-class boatswain mate. And on my hat here is the Presidential Unit Citation. We were the first ship in the fleet to get that.
If you'd like to see a photo of that hat on Stu's head, go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. From the West Virginia at Pearl Harbor to the San Francisco at Cape Esperance and Guadalcanal, he survived so many close calls. And as he shares the rest of his story, we'll get a taste of what he sees as the reason he survived and what drives him to continue telling his story today. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.